Chapter 51. Distinguished by a very large skull, and a great mass of yellow forehead, in deference to which commodities it was currently held in bar rooms, and other such places of resort, that the major was a man of huge sagacity. He was further to be known by a heavy eye and a dull slow manner, and for being a man of that kind who mentally speaking requires a deal of room to turn himself in. But, in trading on his stock of wisdom, he invariably proceeded on the principle of putting all the goods he had, and more, into his window, and that went a great way with his constituency of admirers. It went a great way, perhaps, with Mr. Jefferson Brick, who took occasion to whisper in Martin's ear, "One of the most remarkable men in our country, sir." It must not be supposed, however, that the perpetual exhibition in the marketplace of all his stock in trade for sale or hire was the major's sole claim to a very large share of sympathy and support. He was a great politician, and the one article of his creed, in reference to all public obligations involving the good faith and integrity of his country, was, "Run a moist pen slick through everything, and start fresh." This made him a patriot. In commercial affairs he was a bold speculator. In plainer words, he had a most distinguished genius for swindling, and could start a bank, or negotiate a loan, or form a land-jobbing company entailing ruin, pestilence, and death on hundreds of families with any gifted creature in the Union. This made him an admirable man of business. He could hang about a bar room, discussing the affairs of the nation, for 12 hours together, and in that time could hold forth with more intolerable dullness, chew more tobacco, smoke more tobacco, drink more rum toddy, mint julep, gin sling, and cocktail, than any private gentleman of his acquaintance. This made him an orator and a man of the people. In a word, the major was a rising character, and a popular character, and was in a fair way to be sent by the popular party to the State House of New York, if not in the end to Washington itself. But as a man's private prosperity does not always keep pace with his patriotic devotion to public affairs, and as fraudulent transactions have their downs as well as ups, the major was occasionally under a cloud. Hence, just now Mrs. Pawkins kept a boarding house, and Major Pawkins rather loafed his time away than otherwise. "You have come to visit our country, sir, at a season of great commercial depression," said the Major. "At an alarming crisis," said the Colonel. "At a period of unprecedented stagnation," said Mr. Jefferson Brick. "I am sorry to hear that," returned Martin. "It's not likely to last, I hope." Martin knew nothing about America, or he would have known perfectly well that, if its individual citizens, to a man, are to be believed, it always is depressed, and always is stagnated, and always is at an alarming crisis, and never was otherwise, though as a body they are ready to make oath upon the evangelists at any hour of the day or night, that it is the most thriving and prosperous of all countries on the habitable globe. It's not likely to last, I hope," said Martin. "Well," returned the Major, "I expect we shall get along somehow, and come right in the end." "We are an elastic country," said the rowdy Journal. "We are a young lion," said Mr. Jefferson Brick. "We have revivifying and vigorous principles within ourselves," observed the Major. "Shall we drink a bitter afore dinner, Colonel?" The Colonel assenting to this proposal with great alacrity, Major Pawkins proposed an adjournment to a neighboring bar room, which, as he observed, was only in the next block. He then referred Martin to Mrs. Pawkins for all particulars connected with the rate of board and lodging, and informed him that he would have the pleasure of seeing that lady at dinner, which would soon be ready, as the dinner hour was 2 o'clock, and it only wanted a quarter now. This reminded him that, if the bidder were to be taken at all, there was no time to lose. So he walked off without more ado, and left them to follow, if they thought proper. When the major rose from his rocking chair before the stove, and so disturbed the hot air and balmy whiff of soup which fanned their brows, the odor of stale tobacco became so decidedly prevalent as to leave no doubt of its proceeding mainly from that gentleman's attire. Indeed, as Martin walked behind him to the bar room, he could not help thinking that the great square major, in his listlessness and languor, looked very much like a stale weed himself, such as might be hoed out of the public garden, with great advantage to the decent growth of that preserve, and tossed on some congenial dunghill. They encountered more weeds in the bar room, some of whom, being thirsty souls as well as dirty, were pretty stale in one sense, and pretty fresh in another. Among them was a gentleman who, as Martin gathered from the conversation that took place over the bitter, started that afternoon for the far west on a 6 months' business tour, and who, as his outfit and equipment for this journey, had just such another shiny hat, and just such another little pale valise as had composed the luggage of the gentleman who came from England in the screw. They were walking back very leisurely, Martin arm in arm with Mr. Jefferson Brick, and the Major and the Colonel side by side before them, when, as they came within a house, or two of the Major's residence, they heard a bell ringing violently. The instant this sound struck upon their ears, the Colonel and the Major darted off, dashed up the steps and in at the street door which stood ajar, like lunatics, while Mr. Jefferson Brick, detaching his arm from Martin's, made a precipitate dive in the same direction, and vanished also. Good heaven! Apostrophe, apostrophe, thought Martin. The premises are on fire. It was an alarm bell. Apostrophe, apostrophe, but there was no smoke to be seen, nor any flame, nor was there any smell of fire. As Martin faltered on the pavement, three more gentlemen, with horror and agitation depicted in their faces, came plunging wildly round the street corner, jostled each other on the steps, struggled for an instant, and rushed into the house, a confused heap of arms and legs. Unable to bear it any longer, Martin followed. Even in his rapid progress he was run down, thrust aside, and passed, by two more gentlemen, stark mad, as it appeared, with fierce excitement. Where is it? Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Martin, breathlessly, to a negro whom he encountered in the passage. In a eaten room, saw. Colonel, saw, him kept a seat side himself, saw. Apostrophe, a seat. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Martin. For a dinner, saw. Apostrophe, Martin started at him for a moment, and burst into a hearty laugh, to which the negro, out of his natural good humor and desire to please, so heartily responded, that his teeth shone like a gleam of light. You're the pleasantest fellow I have seen yet, apostrophe, said Martin, clapping him on the back, and give me a better appetite than bitters. Apostrophe, with this sentiment he walked into the dining room, and slipped into a chair next the colonel, which that gentleman, by this time nearly through his dinner, had turned down in reserve for him, with its back against the table. It was a numerous company, 18 or 20 perhaps. Of these some 5 or 6 were ladies, who sat wedged together in a little phalanx by themselves. All the knives and forks were working away at a rate that was quite alarming. Very few words were spoken, and everybody seemed to eat his utmost in self-defense, as if a famine were expected to set in before breakfast time tomorrow morning, and it had become high time to assert the first law of nature. The poultry, which may perhaps be considered to have formed the staple of the entertainment, for there was a turkey at the top, a pair of ducks at the bottom, and 2 fowls in the middle, disappeared as rapidly as if every bird had had the use of its wings, and had flown in desperation down a human throat. The oysters, stewed and pickled, leaped from their capacious reservoirs, and slid by scores into the mouths of the assembly. The sharpest pickles vanished, whole cucumbers at once, like sugar plums, and no man winked his eye. Great heaps of indigestible matter melted away as ice before the sun. It was a solemn and an awful thing to see. Dyspeptic individuals bolted their food in wedges, feeding, not themselves, but brutes of nightmares, who were continually standing at livery within them. Spare men, with lank and rigid cheeks, came out unsatisfied from the destruction of heavy dishes, and glared with watchful eyes upon the pastry. What Mrs. Pawkins felt each day at dinner time was hidden from all human knowledge. But she had one comfort. It was very soon over. When the colonel had finished his dinner, which event took place while Martin, who had sent his plate for some turkey, was waiting to begin, he asked him what he thought of the boarders, who were from all parts of the Union, and whether he would like to know any particulars concerning them. "Pray," apostrophe said Martin, "who is that sickly little girl opposite, with the tight round eyes? I don't see anybody here who looks like her mother, or who seems to have charge of her." Apostrophe, "Do you mean the matron in blue, sir?" Apostrophe asked the colonel, with emphasis. "That is Mrs. Jefferson Brick, sir." Apostrophe, "No, no," apostrophe said Martin, "I mean the little girl, like a doll, directly opposite." Apostrophe, "Well, sir." Apostrophe cried the colonel. "That is Mrs. Jefferson Brick." Apostrophe, Martin glanced at the colonel's face, but he was quite serious. "Bless my soul! I suppose there will be a young Brick then, one of these days?" Apostrophe said Martin. "There are two young Bricks already, sir," apostrophe returned the colonel. The matron looked so uncommonly like a child herself, that Martin could not help saying as much. "Yes, sir," apostrophe returned the colonel, "but some institutions develop human matter, others retard it." Apostrophe, "Jefferson Brick," apostrophe he observed after a short silence, in commendation of his correspondent, "is one of the most remarkable men in our country, sir." Apostrophe, this had passed almost in a whisper, for the distinguished gentleman alluded to sat on Martin's other hand. "Pray, Mr. Brick," apostrophe said Martin, turning to him, and asking a question more for conversation's sake than from any feeling of interest in its subject, "who is that?" Apostrophe he was going to say young, but thought it prudent to eschew the word, "that very short gentleman yonder, with the red nose?" Apostrophe, "That is Professor Mullet, sir," apostrophe replied Jefferson. "May I ask what he is professor of?" Apostrophe asked Martin. "Of education, sir," apostrophe said Jefferson Brick. "A sort of schoolmaster, possibly?" Apostrophe Martin ventured to observe. "He is a man of fine moral elements, sir, and not commonly endowed," apostrophe said the war correspondent. "He felt it necessary, at the last election for president, to repudiate and denounce his father, who voted on the wrong interest. He has since written some powerful pamphlets, under the signature of Suterb, or Brutus Reversed. He is one of the most remarkable men in our country, sir." Apostrophe, "There seem to be plenty of 'em," apostrophe thought Martin, "at any rate." Apostrophe, pursuing his inquiries, Martin found that there were no fewer than four majors present, two colonels, one general, and a captain, so that he could not help thinking how strongly officered the American militia must be, and wondering very much whether the officers commanded each other, or if they did not, where on earth the privates came from. There seemed to be no man there without a title, for those who had not attained to military honors were either doctors, professors, or reverends. Three very hard and disagreeable gentlemen were on missions from neighboring states, one on monetary affairs, one on political, one on sectarian. Among the ladies, there were Mrs. Pawkins, who was very straight, bony, and silent, and a wiry-faced old damsel, who held strong sentiments touching the rights of women, and had diffused the same in lectures. But the rest were strangely devoid of individual traits of character, insomuch that any one of them might have changed minds with the other, and nobody would have found it out. These, by the way, were the only members of the party who did not appear to be among the most remarkable people in the country. Several of the gentlemen got up, one by one, and walked off as they swallowed their last morsel, pausing generally by the stove for a minute or so, to refresh themselves at the brass spittoons. A few sedentary characters, however, remained at table full a quarter of an hour, and did not rise until the ladies rose, when all stood up. "Where are they going?" asked Martin, in the ear of Mr. Jefferson Brick. "To their bedrooms, sir." "Is there no dessert, or other interval of conversation?" asked Martin, who was disposed to enjoy himself after his long voyage. "We are a busy people here, sir, and have no time for that," was the reply. So the ladies passed out in single file, Mr. Jefferson Brick and such other married gentlemen as were left, acknowledging the departure of their other halves by a nod, and there was an end of them. Martin thought this an uncomfortable custom, but he kept his opinion to himself for the present, being anxious to hear and inform himself by the conversation of the busy gentlemen, who now lounged about the stove, as if a great weight had been taken off their minds by the withdrawal of the other sex, and who made a plentiful use of the spittoons and their toothpicks. It was rather barren of interest, to say the truth, and the greater part of it may be summed up in one word: dollars. All their cares, hopes, joys, affections, virtues, and associations seemed to be melted down into dollars. Whatever the chance contributions that fell into the slow cauldron of their talk, they made the gruel thick and slab with dollars. Men were weighed by their dollars, measures gauged by their dollars. Life was auctioneered, appraised, put up, and knocked down for its dollars. The next respectable thing to dollars was any venture having their attainment for its end. The more of that worthless ballast, honor and fair dealing, which any man cast overboard from the ship of his good name and good intent, the more ample stowage room he had for dollars. Make commerce one huge lie and mighty theft. Deface the banner of the nation for an idle rag, pollute it star by star, and cut out stripe by stripe, as from the arm of a degraded soldier. Do anything for dollars. What is a flag to them? One who rides at all hazards of limb and life in the chase of a fox will prefer to ride recklessly at most times. So it was with these gentlemen. He was the greatest patriot, in their eyes, who brawled the loudest, and who cared the least for decency. He was their champion who, in the brutal fury of his own pursuit, could cast no Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.